Happy Monday, everybody. My name's Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio on the 26th of October, a couple of days before Halloween, obviously 2020. And thanks for being with us, be it live or on the archives. And we archive all our shows these days over at our Equity website, which is ace-ed.org. That's A-C-E-E-D. .org. Those are initials for the American Consortium for Equity in Education. And if you go over to ace-ed.org, you'll see a big icon for podcasts. You'll see all our podcasts over there, our schedule, etc. Okay, which we change, by the way, every Saturday. And we got a nice schedule for this week. Again, today is Monday. And also, you can see our magazine over there, Equity in Access, which is just incredibly huge these days and doing great. And it's an online journal. You're welcome to look through it and just read every article. They are good, really good, and a lot of great advertisers and services in there that you might be interested in. We seem to be the only ones focusing on equity and access full-time in the educational media market world, so you might want to take a good look at what we're doing and see that. We also want you to join our consortium. It's free to educators. Again, it's ace-ed.org. We want to make your voice heard. My friend Chris Seely is here today. Chris is the program director, I wanted to get that right, for school and justice initiatives with the American Psychiatric Association Foundation. He's also a clinically trained social worker and obviously a mental health advocate. And we're going to talk today about what disruptive behaviors in school really mean, or while learning, I should say, especially during these crazy remote learning times, and how we should respond with empathy and compassion and really try to understand what's going on. So without further ado, hello, Chris. It's Larry.
Good morning, Larry. How are you doing this morning?
I'm fine. Are you in Washington or Wisconsin today?
I'm in the Washington, D.C. area. We will probably be sticking it out around here, given the current state of what's going on in the Midwest.
Yeah, well, it's bad right now. Wisconsin's bad. I just read an article about Green Bay in the New York Times this morning. Green Bay, of all places, is going wacky with the coronavirus.
Yeah, talking to my mom last week, I had to break the news that we'll probably be planning the holidays around what happens in the next couple of weeks. So,
yeah, well, we're doing, everybody's doing the same thing. And actually, it was interesting,
right.
Yesterday on 60 Minutes, I guess a lot of people watched it last night with the candidates' interviews. Leslie Stahl asked Vice President Pence a question, what should people plan for the holidays, as though he really knows. And he just said the obvious, talk to your family, and if you're an older person and you think there's a big spike somewhere, don't go. I could have answered that. Can I be vice president too? Why'd you ask that silly
question?
I'm
sure you're qualified.
Thank you, buddy. I appreciate that. I really and truly do. Hey, I want to do the show a little bit backwards today, all right, because I want people to understand what the American Psychiatric Association Foundation does. That's your group. And we're going to talk about this school-to-prison pipeline and trauma-informed approaches to handling kids. So let's work a little back. Tell everybody what your group does, okay, particularly with helping teachers and educators understand about trauma-informed approaches. Then we'll get into all those statistics. Chris.
Yes, yeah, sounds good, Larry. Well,
thanks,
you know,
buddy.
As the APA Foundation, you know, our mission is to create a mentally healthy nation for all, where you live, learn, work, and worship. And what we're really focused on here in the schools is where you learn, or where your children learn, or where the youth in your community learn. And what we have found is that, you know, the conversation around equity is that it really does take from the first signs and symptoms to actual connection to care around 8 to 10 years. And that's a considerable gap.
Wow.
Considering during those 8 to 10 years, they're most likely going to engage in unhealthy or negative coping mechanisms or skills. And their mental health concern, whatever they're experiencing, is just going to get worse, right? We're not helping support them during that time. And unfortunately, what we know too is that those individuals, if we don't get them connected to support services sooner, they're more likely to end up in our local county jails. And what we really try to do, I think, with all staff members, and especially in middle and high school, is to help them understand that they are in the perfect position to notice when a youth moves away from their normal or their typical behavior, whatever the individual youth behavior is, and really recognizing those early warning signs. And we break up into disruptive or withdrawn. You know, today we'll talk a little bit more about those disruptive behaviors. And what we really talk about with schools is we can't be so focused on those disruptive behaviors that those withdrawn behaviors also fall through the cracks, right? We really have to take a very much a collaborative team approach to recognizing these behaviors. And once we do notice those changes in the youth behaviors, we want to start a conversation. We want to talk to the student. We want to show that we care. We want to gather information, right? Don't know what's going on. There could be a slew of things that are impacting the student. And we really have to, I think, as an adult member of the community, kind of have to play dumb a little bit, right? Like, I don't know what's going on. Provide with that information to a point. You know, that's always well stressed to staff members is that they're not an investigative detective, right? As a clinically trained social worker, I was trained to handle some very difficult conversations and kind of walk somebody through some of those difficult conversations in an attempt not to re-traumatize them. So we really try to emphasize you don't have to get all the juicy details, right? You don't have to understand all the gossip, if you will. You just need enough information to determine whether or not a referral is appropriate. And though we're a mental health organization, we're not just focused on mental health. This could be homelessness. Yeah. This could be food insecurities. Really anything that's impacting that youth's well-being, right? And once we notice that, once we start a conversation, we get that information, then we need to act, right? We need to connect that student to whatever support services that are needed. And sometimes that act isn't necessarily even connecting that student to support services. It's finding somebody else or finding another staff member that that student has a relationship with, right? There's always an action. Even if a student doesn't talk to you, there's something that you can do. And that's really what we try to reinforce within the school system, is that this is a key framework of Notice, Talk, Act. And we really try to make it fit in there and try to train the staff to better understand that students who are doing disruptive behaviors or, like I said, withdrawn behaviors in the classroom, they're needing more support. They need something else that we're just not providing right now. And we need to figure out that root cause. And that's what our program really is attempting to do.
Right, and good, all good, Chris. And you just mentioned the words train your staff. And that's what you guys can help do. You can do it, as a matter of fact. The American Psychiatric Association Foundation can help schools and educators deal with these things through your programs. Talk about those for a second. Well, not for a second. Talk about them for longer than a second.
All right. When we talk about training your staff, like I said before, it's not just your teacher, right? It's everybody in the school. It's every adult member of your community. We really believe that it's everyone's adult role to notice, talk, and act. And what we do is we go in and we have two different kind of delivery models. You know, we have a direct delivery where either myself or a certified kind of APA instructor works directly with a school. You know, we really see that some schools need help understanding their referral process or really need to work on collecting all of their resources into one place and who owns, bus tokens and who gives them out and some of those nuances that they think everybody knows. But until you have that conversation and kind of put it down on paper and really say, here are my expectations for my staff member when a student is in crisis, for example, or when we don't need to refer a student, this is how we want to build a relationship with our fellow youth in our school. So we kind of have that direct delivery. It's about $20 per staff member. And really what we attempt to do is really work directly with the school. They get an e-learning module that's 30 to 40 minutes self-paced. And then that classroom portion, which is 9 to 120 minutes, we really help to tailor that classroom portion to fit their school needs.
I was just going to ask you that. Are there different programs for elementary, for middle school, for high school? Hey, schools are different, rural versus urban versus suburban, et cetera. Can you guys manufacture differences in your program?
Definitely for the middle and high school, we're working right now to develop an elementary school component.
Oh, cool.
Really, it's about the scenarios that we utilize. You know, the framework works. We also have a college edition as well that we've delivered and pilot tested at a couple of universities as well. And really what we really try to do is we tailor it to your school, right? And I think you bring up a great point, Larry, that every school is different. Even if you look at a school district, right, the middle school might have just a mental health counselor. And then the high school has a social worker, a psychologist, and somebody else, right? So even the resources that you have in your school district, if you're a part of a different school, may vary. And we have to be able to tailor and adjust that. And another key piece that I think it's great that you bring up is this idea of the environment outside of the school, right? That cultural impact that is happening outside of the school doors is also impacting the students as well. And I think that's a big piece of some of the redevelopment that we went through, was really trying to be more culturally aware. What is impacting your students? What does your socioeconomic status look like for your school? Is there a lot of free reduced lunch, right? What other things are impacting your students' well-being? Because we need to have a full picture of this student and of your school community. Because not only are your students probably experiencing that, but your staff as well. And I think anybody who's involved with the mental health training space or going out into the field and training other individuals, you really need to take a look at the individual that you're going to and making sure that their mental health is taken care of too. And I think that's a big piece of even this current pandemic that has even made a shift a little bit when we did some trainings at the end of last year for professional development for some schools. Instead of talking about how we recognize students' mental health, we talked about their mental health as a staff. You know, the pandemic and this COVID-19 is impacting you, and how do you take care of yourself, because you can't pour from an empty cup, as we like to say. So I think that's also a really big piece. We try to really fit into the needs of the school environment, and that's meeting them where they're at as well, and really trying to understand what resources they do have, what resources they don't have, and what are the major challenges that the schools are facing, whether that's, you know, I think all of them are facing youth suicide and technology concerns. Is there substance use issues? Are there other things the staff are struggling with that we can really start to tailor our response, so that the role play, for example, Larry, you know, it's not about this student not turning in their homework. It's about this student showing signs of substance use, right? Really fitting it so it's a scenario that will actually happen in school, so that they really build up that skill. And I think that confidence level to say, hey, if I experience this in a real life setting, at least I have some skill building that I've, you know, maybe in a training session, but I can bring that to the real life experience.
Absolutely. And now I want to get into this. By the way, how do people get in touch? What's the website, Chris, for the program?
Yes. PAFDN.org/schools. So you can find different information on there. We also have some free resources, both for the family and for the school. We're really, really close to releasing a new resource on like parent and caregiver coping skills on how they can work on their coping skills and then take that to the youth that they're maybe overseeing in the household. So that's another resource that we're getting ready to launch, and that will actually be the topic of our next town hall, because we see that as a big piece as parents and the family continue to kind of be impacted by this current pandemic.
Absolutely. And that's PAF, like Frank, right? PAFDN, am I right?
APA.
A is an Adam. Say it again. I'm sorry. Yep. Do it again.
You're fine. APA.
Yep.
FDN.org.
Thank you. Okay, I missed the first A. Forgive me. APAFDN, like American Psychiatric Association Foundation, APAFDN.org. Thanks, Chris. I didn't realize I had missed that first day, so I appreciate that. Now, I want to get into some of the statistics that we talked about as we were planning the show, and that's the school-to-prison pipeline, and there's some key stuff in here. And it's really quite scary, and especially, I don't know if it's going to get better or worse, okay, with remote learning. As you probably know, Boston close their schools for everything but remote learning. Okay, it's just really, really brutal out there, and that's happening more and more. The cases are spiking in our Midwest and Mountain West, etc. It's not really good. But what we're seeing is a lot. And I don't know if this is true now. Can we still recognize disruptive behaviors? Okay, even though we are remote, what should we look for in disruptive behaviors now? Before, you could see spitballs and pushing and screaming and cursing and fighting or whatever the case may be, okay? But now kids are remote, so what should we be looking at? A lot of kids are remote, let me say it that way. What should we be looking for now?
Well, yeah, I think you bring up such a good point is that it's not going to look the same as it did when you were in the classroom, right? And I think that's a big piece to keep in mind is that this has been a big shift for everyone, including your students and the staff members of the school. So it's really about noticing how that student has changed, and that's difficult given the fact that everyone's changed, you know?
Yes.
I think one of the bigger ones to think about is a student who is kind of disrupting the learning environment, right? When you have, I've never sat in an electronic learning classroom in Miller High School. I did it in college, which is, you know, I struggled with that class already. So I'm even trying to think about what it would be like to sit in that. But, you know, when you're thinking about even a Zoom meeting or electronic meeting where you have a screen in front of you, if someone's constantly trying to get your attention, right, to disrupt it, they're in the chat typing things that don't have to maybe relate to what you're talking about. They're looking for attention, right? That's their way of reaching out and trying to show that they would like a little maybe one-on-one time. And I think at any point, whenever you do notice something about a student in this learning environment, it's okay to start a conversation or try to reach out to them and gather more information, right? I think a lot more, Larry, in this remote learning is you're going to see withdrawal behaviors. And that's what we talked a lot
about. They are seeing it.
And there could be a lot of things, right, that's impacting a student's inability to connect. It could be technology issues or just infrastructure, right? If you don't have broadband or Wi-Fi at home, then how are you doing in school? You know, I saw this, I guess, heartbreaking, but also, I guess, very resilient photo of a student who's sitting outside of his school to get the free Wi-Fi from school just to complete it, right? Because the school's closed down, but that's the only place that he can get it, right?
Yeah.
So those are some things as well that I think schools can start to look at. But you also mentioned something about, I don't know if we're going to see an impact due to this remote learning. And actually, in The Lancet, one of our APA members, Dr. Sarah Vincent, along with a professor from Emory Law School, Randy Wollman, actually released a study in The Lancet, The Pandemic Paused the U.S. School-to-Prison Pipeline. And they referenced actually a 27% reduction in adolescent detention populations across 33 states. And this was at when the pandemic first hit at the end of last year and kind of schools just kind of closed down abruptly, is that, you know, they didn't see a spike in juvenile delinquency in those areas. You know, it wasn't like these disruptive students taking the disruption from the classroom out into the streets or out into the home or into these different areas, right? It's how we're responding in the school that's creating those referrals from the school to those detention facilities.
Ah, that's interesting.
There's more for us to learn about that. And I think, you know, it's probably also our investment. And I did want to mention that your good friend, Dr. Rich Long,
Learning First.
Along with the National Association of Elementary School Principals, actually put together a partnership blog on our website really around the need for schools to invest in mental health services, right? And I think that's really, really big, right? Is that we've invested in school resource officers for protection and safety of students. But we've created more harm than good, I think, in a lot of ways, because we haven't necessarily beefed up the rest of the support services in this school. You know, 14 million students in this country have access to a school resource officer, but not one of the following: a nurse, a social worker, or a psychologist. So, you know, we're lacking in the support services. So when you can only refer to a school resource officer, that's the only support services that your school has. Well, that's you're going to send a disruptive student, and that's where and that's where that connection starts. And unfortunately, we know the path, right? Once you get connected, especially as a juvenile, you know, as their brain works, it's that self-fulfilling prophecy, right?
Yeah,
Larry, we tell you that you are no good, and then you believe it, and then you start to do things that fit into that idea of yourself. You're going to engage in more risk-taking behavior because adults, people who you respect in your community, have told you that you're not going to be better than what you are right now.
Right, and it's interesting, Chris. And I'm going to say what you already know. You know, school resource officers are well-trained people. okay? But they are not school psychologists and counselors, okay? They are police officers, okay? And as such, they are trained, although to work in schools as police officers, okay? So they're going to react like a police officer does, which isn't necessarily bad, okay? But it's not as professionally trained as a psychiatrist, et cetera. And that's why we have to be very careful about what kids and how we relate to them. And again, the school resource officers I know and have worked with are absolutely excellent, but they're not trained, okay, to do the job of being a school psychologist. Okay, we have to be very, very aware that they are officers of the law. Okay, and again, not that there's anything bad with that, but it's a different mindset. Right?
Right. We can't.
Is that a good way to put it?
You know, I wouldn't. Yeah, exactly. I wouldn't expect myself as a social worker to be able to do their job, right? Like, and I think it's the same, right? Like, we have a certain set of skills, just like they have a certain set of skills.
Exactly.
And I think what we have to do a better job of, I think, within the larger context of society, is really placing these experts in positions to succeed, not in positions to be the end all be all in their community or in their school setting, because like you said, they're not trained to handle these conversations.
They're not trained.
Most
of the ones I meet are great people. They do give a damn.
Yeah.
They really give a damn about these kids. Okay. And, and a lot of them will treat the kids to lunch if they need it and that sort of thing. I've heard those stories. They're good people. Okay. But it's not the answer to the challenge that we're giving them. Okay. When you simply refer over to that. Okay. It's an unfair challenge.
Right. I think there's also something to be said, you know, in any context as an adult, right? We tend to have the authority, right? Whenever we step into a room full of kids, we believe that we have that authority and we need to have that. And I think part of when a student is experiencing any kind of turmoil in their lives, sometimes their behaviors aren't necessarily connected to how they're actually doing.
Exactly. Good point.
They're doing something else and they're not even quite sure why, right? And I think as an adult, we have to realize that. I mean, I always think, Larry, you know, have you ever been upset with somebody that you were trying to email back
never.
And you wrote a very angry email, right?
No, never, never.
And
of course
stopped,
not.
Right?
Me. Yeah.
Hopefully you stopped, right? And then you paused, you took some time, stepped back, you gave yourself some space, gave time for those emotions to kind of be there, right? If you're angry, you let that anger be there. But then you kind of go back to logical mind and you go, okay, as a professional, how can I communicate this so that this person understands and so that I don't look like a jerk, right? I think that's where a lot of that comes from. We don't even allow students to do that when we know that they have a lack of a prefrontal cortex fully developed to make those logical decisions, right? We don't allow them the space to take a break or to allow their emotions to be had. We just expect them to listen to us right away, right? If you're being disruptive, you need to listen to me right now. Well, no, my brain's not even checked in to what you're telling me right now. I need time. I need space. I need an opportunity to cool down. And then maybe we can come back to this conversation. And that's what, you know, I think I'll encourage schools to do, and also especially homes and in families, is when youth is emotionally distressed, you need to give them space. You need to give them an opportunity to cool down,
come
back to the conversation. I think that you can have a logical conversation about consequences, about everything else that you want to have as that adult or as a parent or as an authority figure, as a school resource officer, but you need to allow logic to come back into the conversation. And a lot of times, too, as adults, as soon as we enter into that argument with the student, we've already lost, because that's all they wanted. They wanted to
angry. Yeah.
They wanted to yell. So now they won. They got what they wanted, but we didn't get what we wanted. We didn't get information.
Yeah.
We don't understand what's going on with the youth, and we can't support them. So
yeah, and
lost.
You know, of course, the conundrum of that is that you're in a classroom setting. There's 30 kids looking at you, or 20 kids looking at you, handling the situation. Okay, and if a kid is out of control, it affects everyone else. That's why your training is so important, because you don't want to aggravate that child. You want that child to be successful in the long run, okay? But you have to be able to control your class as well, again, if there are classes, et cetera, and even during a remote thing, okay? So you have to build a relationship. It's really just – that's why your training from APA is so important, Chris. It's just so damn important. And I got to say something else. There's another thing. okay, we're talking about this and just referring kids over to the school resource officer, et cetera. There's an interesting statistic, all right, and I'm going to ask you about this. 70% of student arrests or students referred to law enforcement are black or Latino. Okay, let's go say that again. 70% of student arrests or students referred to law enforcement are black and or Latino. Okay, why? Is there an implicit bias built into this somewhere along the line? What's going on there? Is there any rationale for that?
Yeah, I definitely think the simple answer to your question, Larry, yes. I think there is implicit bias going on in these situations. I think a lot of times the white student in these situations, right, you have a white student who becomes disruptive, they're afforded a little bit more of that compassion and that empathy. They're met with the compassion and empathy sooner and quicker than a student who is black or Latinx. I think a lot of times those students are seen as easy to remove. I remove this problem student, then I get rid of the issue. And I think, honestly, Larry, what we see playing out more visibly now over the last, 5 to 7 years, really since social media has hit with the killing of unarmed black men, this is where it probably starts, is, you know, when you're in a classroom that's predominantly white and this one student who is black or Latino.
Even if it's in a classroom that's predominantly African American or Latino, if you're white, a teacher, then it could go the other way as well. Yeah, there is implicit bias in this, without question.
Remove that student, right? To easily remove them from disrupting your learning. Well, now that becomes learned behavior, and the availability of us as community members to pick up the phone when someone's being just call a law enforcement officer there to remove them because they're disrupting whatever we believe society should look like. That's where it starts, right? The access to that.
That is a very interesting point, what you just said, to determine what we think society should look like. Okay, and what you just said is basically that we need more culturally responsive education, okay, and more culturally responsive educators. Not that everybody's not trying. I don't mean to point that out, but it's really important because African-American people, I'll just say this, I know it's a stereotype, I watch NFL football, can be a bit more exuberant than the white guys playing, okay? It's a different culture. And that's to be celebrated, by the way, okay? And my point is that when someone reacts one way and it's not the way you react, you can react in a negative manner. But it's not necessarily a negative thing that they're doing. And we have to move and ask them what's going on, why that reaction. That's why this training you offer is so important again.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? Am I being an amateur psychologist here, or what's going on? Am I doing all right?
Well, I think what you're alluding to is the fact that whenever we see something that is different, it is wrong, right? Like, this is different. This is
that's
not
what
how
I mean.
I would react.
And that's culturally
wrong,
culturally
right?
Responsive
and
work. Yeah.
Exactly. It's not wrong. It's different. It's not like I would do, or not like my this person would do. But it doesn't mean that it's wrong.
So
it's
see it as aggressive or
an
annoying,
expression.
And your reaction is to bring it under control. Okay.
Passionate and enthused, and I think that was, I think it's interesting, even if you sat down and this was an activity that I did during my social work grad school kind of training, is we were asked to kind of sit down and write down 4 or 5 common things that we think about when we think of a white family versus a black family. And as we shared out into the classroom, I would say 80 to 90% of the students were in my class. When we got to the black family, they were disproportionately negative. Instead of focusing on strong family ties, resiliency, some of these different things that we always go to the negative, unfortunately. And I think
that's sort of
the implicit bias that we have. And I think as mental health professionals, that is something that mental health professionals have to get better at, especially looking at the disproportionate amount of Black and Latinx individuals that are connected to proper support services. Like, this is an area, I think, when we talk about implicit bias, Larry, that everyone has to continue to, no one is an expert. You just have to continue to learn, and you need to continue to grow and understand that we don't know it all. And part of that is a part of listening and understanding this person, from their perspective, from their cultural viewpoints, from their lived experience. And that's what our training is really attempting to do, is to say,
that's right.
This person that's in your classroom, they're an individual, they've gone through things, and we want to understand that because we can better support them. And by kicking them out, we know that that reduces their chances of success. And don't we want all of our community members to be successful? Because, again, I think that's what I always try to come back to, even when I'm talking about the jail population, is that these are all of our community members. These are our neighbors, right? When we remove a student from our school system, we've basically failed them. You know, we have failed them as a community member because we haven't allowed them the chance to grow. We haven't,
And we hurt ourselves because, again, it's all part of the same community. We hurt ourselves.
Our community can't become better. It can't evolve, you know. They get stuck. And I think that's a lot of where we're at today in society, is the reason that we're stuck in some of these, what I would consider, polarizing conversations, is because we haven't allowed enough time to get to know each other and to kind of sit down and say, well, what is your lived experience and what is your viewpoint, and how
That's
can
right.
I better understand you as a community member, and how do we come together?
It's a great point. I know your training, Chris, the training's from, not yours, the training from the APA Foundation, okay? It all comes together to make to educators. We were talking about police officers before. Educators are also not really trained in this. And that's why it's so important for everybody to take advantage of the programs that are out there like yours. Okay? Because we are faced with these challenges, and instead of getting them aggravated and making mistakes, let's get it right. Everybody, it's the APA Foundation, American Psychiatric Association Foundation, APAFDN.org. And this is Chris Seeley, who's their program director for school and justice initiatives. Chris, you did good. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, Larry. Really appreciate it, and always welcome an invite to talk to you.
You're always welcome here. And by the way, tell your mom I hope the Bears win tonight.
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm not going to relay that
message. Is she the Packers fan or the Bears fan?
No, she's the Bears fan. I'm the Packers
fan.
I'm hoping they lose tonight so that we can at least share a tie of the NFC North. my grandma was not happy last week. We were texting very furiously back and forth about how poor the Packers were playing. So,
well, what can I tell you? We'll see what happens tonight against the Rams for the Bears. That's funny. Okay, so good luck to her. That's all I have to say. Good luck to her.
I'm not going to pass on that luck. I'm going to hold that luck for myself, Larry. But
all I can do is say
fun.
It publicly. The messenger must relay it, or it doesn't get over there. Maybe you'll send her the podcast. She can listen. Okay, thanks, Chris.
That's what I'll do. Thanks, Larry.
Let her hear you on the air. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Larry. You have a good day.
You're welcome, buddy. Have a good week. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
That's Chris Seeley, everybody. The American Psychiatric Association Foundation. They have great programs for schools. Get in touch at apafdn.org. That's their website. Check it out. All right, we're going to archive at ace-ed.org. Please go over, join our consortium. It's all about equity these days. You heard it just now. I'm Larry Jacobs. Thanks for listening.